So, you know cussing is allowed?
Okay.
Why are you laughing?
No, that's good. I like the disclaimer in the beginning.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, if we're going to talk about things that are dark anyways, you need to do a little bit of cussing, right?
I agree. Mm-hmm. People ask me a lot why I have some cursing in my poems occasionally. I find that interesting.
They do, eh? That is an
interesting... Yeah.
Like... I guess they figure it's what, not ladylike or something, or like what's the,
where did I'm sure there's a touch. I'm sure there's a touch of that, but I think also there's a few reasons. Probably innocently, they assume maybe my readership is for like younger people, and that's not the case.
Oh, okay.
But I always recommend like parent, like if you are even considering your book for someone younger, you should read it first and decide.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people just don't like cursing. They think that it doesn't add anything.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, like I said, because of your themes, which is mm-hmm. mainly like grief and struggle and like trying to hold it together and not doing a good job of it, like the occasional
right.
F-bomb or anything else is like acceptable in those circumstances, right?
I agree. Yeah. People are out of desperation. People curse. Like,
mm-hmm.
give me a break.
Yo, welcome to my summer lair. I'm your host, Sammy. I never ever leave when the music is just getting good. Yunnan. If I ask you, I guess this is not really an if because I'm going to ask you anyways, but if I ask you what comes to your mind when I say Edgar Allan Poe, you'll probably conjure up goth or gothic related images. His obsession with death and darkness, black cats, and of course ravens. All of that is not just a Poe shorthand, that's an inaccurate perception. Okay, yes, he wrote The Tattletale Heart, but Poe also wrote science fiction, lots of journalisms and essays for literary journals and periodicals. In his time, he was known for his own style of literary criticism. Basically, Poe is Rotten Tomatoes. He was the go-to guy for criticism on books and writing. Poe also wrote a substantial number of satires, hoaxes, and humorous pieces. He wrote comedy. Yeah, and none of this fits with our image of Poe, the guy who stayed up all night listening to The Cure and writing The Fall of the House of Usher by candlelight. I was thinking about Poe and all that flawed public perception we cling to as I sat down to talk to Alicia Cook. Sure, maybe that's good branding or the profitable benefit of owning a niche. Here's the thing. Poe is gone. We can only get to know him through his work, which is why that perception is fueled. Thankfully, Alicia's here, and it turns out she's more than her work. Alicia Cook is a writer and poet from New Jersey. The Music Was Just Getting Good is her third and final book of her poetry mixtape trilogy. It follows Stuff I've Been Feeling Lately and Sorry I Haven't Texted You Back. If you've been online in like the last 10 years or something, like you've probably seen some variation of Sorry I Haven't Texted You Back. It went viral because it effortlessly captures that I can't get out of bed and deal with life emotion. In her writing and work, Alicia's themes are grief, death, and loss. Death, of course, can mean the loss of a relationship, like when you break up with someone, as much as a physical demise. She also writes about addiction and the harsh impact it has on families and friends. Yeah, these are dark and heavy topics. You would think she would be going on road trips with Edgar Allan Poe. They're both poets, right? And it turns out that, like Edgar Allan Poe, Alicia Cook is funny and charming. In this conversation, she shares one of her favorite comedies. That was a movie I was not expecting her to reveal, but I'm so glad she did. So yeah, let's hear what the poet who wrote The Music Was Just Getting Good has to say about life and death and karaoke and string cheese. Stephanie, if you please.
Sound, the final frontier. My summer lair is an enterprise, a pop culture voyage with a continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new creators and celebrate established producers, to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. And now here is your host, Sammy Yunnan.
Do you have any questions for me, or should we start talking about when the music was just getting good.
Oh, we could get right to it.
All right. The Music Was Just Getting Good is the third and final book, is that right, in your poetry mixtape trilogy?
Yeah. Yep.
So it follows Stuff I've Been Feeling Lately from 2018, and Sorry I Haven't Texted You Back, oh no, in 2020. And then here, I got to read this line, because you have a poem where you have a conversation with your father, and the music was just getting good. This is on page 58. Why are you laughing? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. It's I have my book right here, so I'm going to read along with you.
All right.
And actually, Stuff I've Been Feeling Lately first came out in 2016 and then was republished in 2017. Yeah. So every 4 years, a mixtape has been coming out.
Yeah, because that one was the self-published one? Was that the one that was?
Yeah. And then Andrews McMeel traditionally published it in 2017.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah, just a little technical thing.
No, it's good. Like, I appreciate it. So I get this right. Because this is where my question is coming from. On page 58, this is track 47. All the poems in the Music Was Just Getting Good have like track names. So this is track 47.
Yeah.
And in the last stanza, you're writing about a conversation you're having with your father. And he says to you, "You're one of the special ones," he assured me, "because you can appreciate the start and the end of things and find a certain relief in both." And so, because this is the third one, and it's the end of this trilogy, for you as a poet, like, are you attracted to endings or beginnings?
That's a great question. I think this was an actual conversation I had once with my father.
Mm-hmm.
At a crossroads in my life. And I think the answer is both. I love starting things. I love the process. My most favorite thing is to start creating. But in this instance, with the third and final mixtape, like I am a little relieved that I'm able to close this chapter. Maybe, you know, who knows what's next.
In terms of the creative process, you said you like starting and doing, being creative and whatever. Does it feel, I guess, complete when you finally now like have shipped it, like you posted it on IG, like a poem on IG, or the book is in the bookstores, whatever for you is considered like shipped or finished or published? Like, is there a sense of like a relief, or is it just always the act of creating that's the main focus for you, and then the rest is kind of like the icing on the cake in a sense?
Yeah, the latter. So I the creating and the process of it all, as soon as I hand my manuscript to my publisher and I know that I can't make any more changes, and that could be like 9 months really out from the release date, I'm done with that book. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
By the time it's in stores, I like to always say that it becomes the reader's. Like, it's not mine anymore. I kind of cease ownership of it, because the reader's going to interpret it and absorb it however they're going to. And that's like a different phase of the process. And it's great, but the creative process is where it's at for me.
That's almost like a movie, right? Because a filmmaker will spend like maybe up to a year casting it and shooting it and in the editing room and getting all the right scenes or whatever. And then this big day comes and then they release it and they're done. There's nothing else they can kind of do. I know there's like special features and things they put on DVDs, but for the most part, it's done. And so the audience can then consume it however they want. And if they think it's funny or not funny, or if it's a horror movie and it was never meant to be a horror movie, like however the audience receives it, like the filmmaker's job is done.
Absolutely. And that's whether someone loves it or hates it or is indifferent about it, there's nothing I could do once it's on a shelf, you know? So I like that analogy. And that's the same with any art, music, writing, creating in any medium. It stops being ours as soon as it's available to the public.
Do you get impatient with that gap? As you said, you have 8 to 9 months, like once you drop it off at the publisher, like, because you know you have some good stuff here and you want people to connect with it. You want them to like read it, to like think about it, color it, highlight it. Like, do you get impatient, or you're like...
I think it's more nerves than impatience, because especially for these mixtape books, it takes me about, you know, it's 4 years between releases, and that is an eternity
mm-hmm.
in the social media world, you know, like... I'm sometimes worried about my relevance. sometimes worried about, you know, are they even going to care that this is the last mixtape? You know, that those thoughts creep into my head, and I think that's natural. But I don't get impatient because I'm always creating. So a thing I do is I date. I don't know if you noticed, I date the books. So I say when I wrote it between.
Mm-hmm.
So this book I wrote between March 2020 and April 2023. But if you recall, sorry, I haven't texted you back, came out in October of 2020. So I was already writing this before Sorry, I Haven't Texted You Back even came out.
Yeah. And so do the emotions kind of change, like, once you finish the project, then, like, do you start thinking about the next one right away, or do you need some time off, or like, for to like regroup in terms of emotions, right?
Yeah. So I usually don't write at all the first like couple months of a book release. So once it's out, I'm thinking of, I need to push this book. I don't know if it's writer's block or what, but I do not usually write or write well when a book is being released. But usually my books never start as like, oh, this could be a book. So when I started writing this in March 2020, I wasn't literally writing. The music was just getting good. I was just writing. Mm-hmm. And as like the Word document filled up and the drafts filled up, I considered, I was like, oh, this could be another book. And I noticed that I was leaning more into grief, which makes sense because I started writing this during the start of the pandemic.
So we're going to circle back to grief, but mm-hmm. all three books, and even readers can tell from the title, right? The music was just getting good. They're all music based. Like, every poem ends with a currently listening to song. There's a lot of music in here. If you and a handful of friends went out for karaoke night one night in New Jersey, like, what's on your playlist? What are you belting out? What are you singing?
Oh my God. I mean, if I could sing, I would be belting out probably like Whitney or Mariah.
Oh, yeah. But you're reaching for the stars there, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if, I mean, it's a hypothetical situation. So in this situation, I could sing. I'm singing like Whitney and Mariah. And even my friends that like really can't sing, they're always singing, you know, Mariah, Whitney, especially, you know, Whitney's from New Jersey.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm belting out. And they are in my, you know, in my books, in the playlist.
And like, do you ever do that thing where you pull into the driveway where like you've arrived at your destination, or maybe you're at home, and but you got to stay in the car for a couple more minutes just until a song comes to an end as a music person?
Yeah, I never. I mean, fun fact, I guess, about me, and I'm finding a lot of people do this for some reason. I never immediately get out of my car and into my house. I sit in the driveway, and even if I'm just looking at my phone. So yes, there's always a lapse between me and my house. I don't know why. I've always been like that.
That's kind of nice in a way. It's like a way to reset.
I think so. Or like, yeah, you know, after a long day, sometimes it's like, what am I walking into? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do sit in my car often.
Yeah, because you mentioned the pandemic when you were writing in 2020, and that was one of the things that kind of messed up a lot of people, was we lost a lot of the social cues. Because normally pre-pandemic, you would get up, you shower, get dressed, then you go to work, you jump on the subway, right? And then you go to like work. That's kind of average commute for a person. But when you started working from home, you lost that subway. And so you had the end of the social cues, you know what I mean? So your day would end at like 4:35 or whatever it is, and then you would get up from the desk, and then you would walk over to the couch and sit there and watch Netflix. Like, there was no cues, there was no break. So I get what you're saying when you sit in front of the, like, your house for a couple of minutes just in the car, just to have that social cue and that kind of break. Like, this part of the day is done, and now on to the next part.
Yeah, yeah. And the pandemic, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes to, like, how important a routine is, even if you have nothing going on that day.
Mm-hmm. So on page 41, let's go back to your book. On page 41.
Okay.
This is
a timely one.
Okay. This is track 32. I just want to focus on the first two lines because I think this is interesting. Like, you write, I've always hated snow. I preached there. Like, that's, I agree with you completely. I've always hated snow. A main topic of conversation during any first date. And I'm curious because, like, again, similar to the karaoke hypothetical, when you are on a first date, like, how do you explain what it is that you do? You do a bunch of stuff. So how do you, like, explain? Because sometimes people are not familiar with Instagram poetry. Some people, you know what I mean? So if you're on this date, and this is, of course, assuming that you're with a boy that eats his string cheese properly, right?
Well, that's the first thing.
Yeah. So he wouldn't have gotten a first date if he didn't eat his string cheese properly, which is a reference from Sorry I Haven't Texted You Back. But assuming that,
yes,
assuming he eats his string cheese properly and this boy has passed the litmus test, how would you describe what you do on a first date?
Well, I haven't gone on a first date in many, many years, but I would explain it how I explain it to anyone I meet in passing or in conversation now. I don't want to say it's a good thing, but I also have my foot in like the corporate world as well. I write, professionally as well, not just creatively. So I usually start with that. I don't always lead with like, oh, I'm a published author. I have a internet presence. I often don't do that. And then when like after the fact, if someone finds me online, they're like, whoa, you left this whole part of your life out. So I probably don't do that the right way, but I do sometimes I withhold that part of my life because sometimes I feel like I don't want to come across like I'm bragging or that I think that there is some like elite benefit of having a following online. Like, so I usually just say that I write for a living. And then if the questions continue, I get a little more specific, but usually it's like someone looks me up and they're like, oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You played it down a lot.
Which is nice, though, because, like, again, like, on a first date, you want to leave a little bit of mystery, right? You don't want to give all your secrets away. Like,
yeah, and the same with anything. If I'm meeting a stranger at an event or something, why do I have to unload my resume to you? Mm-hmm. It should be, like, a more, like, organic unfolding of who I am. And who I am really professionally or how I exist on the internet shouldn't factor into my worth when we're face-to-face.
That makes sense. But at the same time, too, is there like, I guess, a concern that like a boy would end up like in one of the poems, maybe even in a negative context, like the guy who didn't eat string cheese properly? Do you know what I mean? And like,
yeah, well, I write autobiographically. I don't make anything up. Mm-hmm. So it's either everything you've read is either based on myself or like a friend's story. I'm not saying I don't exaggerate it. Right. I probably exaggerate it. But who says it? Anne Lamott, right? Anne Lamott says that if someone wanted you to write warmly about them, they should have behaved better.
Okay. Well taken. Well point. Good point. And as I said, that poem opens up with "I've always hated the snow." But recently in one of your newsletters, you talk about the pouring rain. So on January 9, when this book, The Music Was Just Getting Good, was coming out, you write, "It poured rain all day, did not let up once. Now, a rainy day in January in New Jersey is never great, but it felt like a good omen for me, mostly because it rains on important days in my life." Can you expand on that? What did you mean by that?
So anytime something super magnificent has happened in my life, it's rained. It's just something, my mother actually pointed it out to me. She's like, every time something big happens for you, it's raining, like 9 times out of 10. So, the day The Music Was Just Getting Good came out, it was torrential rain, like not just a drizzle. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm fine with this because it's a good omen for me. But like I said, I know it's hypothetical, but I haven't gone on a first date in many years. So I think that how I view a first date or even like small talk with friends or like acquaintances, something that tires me very quickly is talking about things that don't really matter, like filler conversation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of time, I think that snow comment, I do hate snow.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
But I do hate snow.
If we are in the same room together, I'll give you a high five for that. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I have like 9 inches outside right now. Mm-hmm. But I hate snow, but it's the idea of like, it's a topic of every first date because it's filler and it's nothing. Mm-hmm. So even when people are talking about the weather, I'm like, oh, why are we talking about the weather? I see the weather.
Right. Like you have a window.
Right. Like I want to dive in more and talk more about other things. Like I want to know how people are really doing and mm-hmm. things like that. So I feel like a lot of times weather is like a crutch of a conversation starter. Like they, when they don't know what to say, they bring up the weather.
Yeah. The way you're talking, it's the thing that a lot of us do almost habitually or unconsciously, where somebody will ask you like, how are you doing? And then you just say fine, or I'm good. Or how was your weekend? And you just say good. And you kind of gloss over a lot of emotional upheaval or whatever it is. Like, you know what I mean? Like sometimes we feel like we can't burden or answer that question properly. Like, how are you feeling? Or how was your weekend?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the whole crux of Sorry I Haven't Texted You Back in that poem in my last book, about like we kind of censor ourselves and redact what we actually want to say because we don't know how the other person would take it, or we don't know what the other person's going through. We don't want to add to their burdens. So we do that a lot as a species.
What about vocabulary? Because that's also a difficult part. Three books later, and I know you've written other things as well, but for just focusing on this mixtape trilogy, do you feel you have this vocabulary to express your hurt and your pain, especially in a way that lets you feel understood? Because sometimes that can be difficult as well. Like, the reason why we always just say fine or good is because it's like, it's a good shorthand, but it's a lot more difficult to try to like articulate some of the things that you're feeling.
Oh, yeah. And I absolutely don't want to downplay how hard it is sometimes to articulate how you're feeling to even someone that is very close to you. I do have the language to express how I'm feeling at any given moment of any given day. But whether I decide to use that vocabulary and actually talk about how I'm feeling is another story. Like I have to want to speak about this and how I'm feeling. So I also fall into the habit of sometimes being like, oh yeah, I'm just busy, or I'm just tired, mm-hmm. when it's a lot more deeper than that. But that's me deciding not to use the tools I know I have to articulate how I'm feeling, versus maybe someone who isn't that far along on like their journey, mm-hmm. of understanding what makes them tick and what might trigger them or something like that. But all these years later, all these therapy sessions later, I know how to ask questions to other people to get them to inadvertently open up as well.
Is the concern, or part of the concern, of being too messy? You know, like hugging somebody who just came in from the rain and now your shirt gets wet too. Because, you know, somebody could be having a good day. They could be getting promoted at work or like whatever. Or they had a good first date, right, with somebody who eats string cheese properly. Like, and then you come in with your like, I guess your hurt and your pain and your grief. And it sometimes those things kind of clash. And so there's a concern of being messy with somebody, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes sense. And that's not wanting to be a burden to someone, not wanting to ruin their day. Mm-hmm. But if that person truly cares for you and loves you, they will hold space for you. And I always say that it could be the sunniest day of the year until it isn't. You know, in my first book, I think I talk about how the worst day of my life happened to be like the sunniest, most bluest sky day of that year. So no one would have known. Mm-hmm. What was going on with me, because everyone was so happy. The weather was so nice. So there's that dichotomy of like, you don't always know what you're walking into, especially when you're in a relationship or a friendship or in a family. Everyone goes through their own shit. So you could be having the best day and walk in, and if someone you care about is crying or needing you, you should be able to hold space for them and not, I know I would.
You're such a poet. Like, the sunny days are the dark days, and then the rainy days are like the good omens. Like, that's such a poet.
Yeah, right? And that's unintentionally cliche, but yeah.
And as you've written this stuff and obviously posted a lot on IG, I'm sure you've connected with a lot of people. I'm sure you've gotten some like dark stories too in your DMs, things like that. Like, as you connect with this audience and writing about mental health and grief and trauma, have you learned, or can you identify, like, is there a check engine light to grief, you know? And I know we do ignore check engine lights when they go on in the car anyways, But is there anything that you kind of notice, or like as an analogy, is there a check engine light to grief?
Well, I think everyone's different. So I think that brings the check engine light in my mind is like the triggers before the trigger. Like I could, and that could go the same with grief. It could be the same for when you feel your mental health starts to decline. I know my mental health is declining before I can't get off the couch. And then I have to decide, am I going to, you know, put some work in to avoid ending up on the couch, or am I going to just like let it take me this time?
Mm-hmm.
And I think grief is the same.
It's almost
like
fighting against the tide or a riptide.
Absolutely. And you have to decide whether you want that wave to take you or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll admit it, because I feel like a lot of people who might listen to this agree, like are in the same boat. More than half the time, I just let my bad day take me.
You stop swimming against the current and just let it.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, because I know, though, mm-hmm. that I will come back out of it. There was a time in my life, maybe, where I didn't think I would come back out of it. And that's when things get really treacherous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when people start wondering, why am I even alive? And it can get really dark really fast. So my recommendation to anyone I talk to, of course, is never to, you know, do all you can to pull yourself out of it. But at the same time, I'm slightly a hypocrite, but I know I'm in a space where like, I know I'll come back out of it. And same goes for grief. So like some people, you know, like if a birthday, like if a milestone date's coming up and the person that you lost is no longer here, you might feel that creeping in, be like, oh, the date's getting closer. Some people don't care about dates, and some people are triggered, you know, by the change of the season or a smell, or if a movie like the Wicked movie that's coming out,
mm-hmm.
my cousin Jessica, who, you know, passed away so long ago, she would have loved that a Wicked movie was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about that. When my aunt died, when Jess's mom died last year, that grief all bubbled up again, because then I lost my aunt and Jess, and it was the three of us often. So I'm the only like memory keeper now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going through stuff like that, but I knew I was going through it. And for someone who may not have experienced that type of grief or mental health issue before, and they're experiencing something for the first time, they might not be able to recognize that. And they might be wondering if something's wrong with them. And it's not. All of this is very natural. Like you don't live on this earth and not feel grief.
Yeah, an analogy of what I'm thinking about, like when you talk, is that like if you have like a Honda Civic, for example, right? That's a bad example, but if you have a Honda Civic and it gets stolen one day, right? It's a lot of trauma, because now you got to call insurance, you got to deal with all this stuff, whatever. You have to figure out how to get a new car, you have to do all this stuff or whatever. But every now and then, like years after, you'll see a Honda Civic one day at an intersection or something like this, and it might like trigger. Like, oh man, remember when my car got stolen? Like, there's a loss there. You know what I mean? Like, you eventually will get a new car and you deal with the insurance and all the other stuff and you get past it. But there's a weird loss there for something that, like, you know, you didn't really expect. Like, you didn't see it
right.
coming.
Right. And something, and in that analogy, that's something that is replaceable. And I want to, like, a big part of my book, the new one, is that grief doesn't have to be just the loss of a permanent thing, mm-hmm. a permanent life. It could be stuff that you know might come back around in a different form or even in the same form. But you're allowed to feel grief in that moment for something that you lost or didn't come to be or anything like that. And I want to normalize that more. Like if your car gets stolen, that really sucks. And you're allowed to be upset about that. Is it the end of the world? It might be for you if that's your only mode of transportation and now you can't get to work or you can't figure out how to move your kids around. And I feel like a lot of times we like to put our own experience onto situations, and maybe like losing a car isn't mm-hmm. the biggest deal to some people, but to other people, it will wreck their lives for quite some time. And I just think that that's all forms of grief and loss and trauma.
But the loss and the grief and the trauma that you're talking about is that sometimes people can be impatient with sitting with that. You know what I mean? It's a lot like waiting for a delayed flight. There's nothing you can do when the airplane's going to take off is when the airplane's going to take off. So even though the ticket said 2:00, the wing may have fallen off or something like that, so they got to put the wing back on. Like, there's nothing you can do, but you have a choice: either like be impatient and be frustrated and angry and cussing out people or whatever, or you can kind of just sit there with that delay, I guess, and just kind of be in the moment.
So for me, I like the plane analogy. For me, I'm very much of a there's nothing we could do type of person when in those scenarios. And I think it's because the loss I had in my life where I'm just like, it's not the end of the world. We'll get there when we get there. There's nothing, this is out of our control. Mm-hmm. I'm very good at recognizing what is truly out of my control and what isn't.
That's a good superpower.
You know, grant me. Yeah. I mean, and it comes from loss, of course, and learning to navigate that, in my opinion. But I think that we set ourselves up for failure when it comes to grief and getting through it, because there's no getting through grief. You learn to coexist with it. Mm-hmm. But we set ourselves up for failure because our society likes to, put a start and finish to things. So the five stages of grief, mm-hmm. that it's not real and it's not linear at best. So I think that a lot of people need to rewire their brain on the fact that there is no end to grief once you feel it. You have good days, you have sad days, but you learn to coexist with your grief. It's never gone.
Yeah, it's not a road trip. Like, you like Big Sean, so if you got tickets to see Big Sean in Detroit and you're gonna drive from New Jersey to Detroit, grief is not the same way. Like, you, when you get to Detroit, you've arrived and you know how many miles you have left, and you can stop for some Burger King, some McDonald's or whatever. You can do whatever you want along the way, but you know when you've arrived. And grief is the opposite of what you're talking about, where like you can't just put in like healing or hope or something into a GPS and then get there like a couple miles later.
No, it's a beautiful thought. I mean, there'd be a lot less pain in the world if there was an end date to people's grief. But that's just not the case. And I think a lot of people have trouble reckoning with that truth, because even me, who understands that inherently there is no end to grief, I get frustrated with myself sometimes because I am a very type A person in a lot of regards. And I like crossing things off my list. And you just can't do that, especially when it comes to any form of healing.
Mm-hmm. So let's switch topics a little bit. We've been talking about a lot of grief and darkness, mental health, I guess all the sad girl winter themes of your poetry, right?
Yeah.
And occasionally, like also in your poems too, there is some like a nod to like iced coffee, which you seem to drink a lot. So at the risk of ruining your online brand, like what makes you laugh, Alicia? Like, are there certain like stand-up comics that make you laugh, or comedy movies that make you shoot iced coffee through your nose? Like... What makes you laugh?
Yeah, I was just talking about this with my friend who was part of my book launch event. That, because I don't love doing events, but the best part of an event for me is that a lot of times when I'm speaking, or if it's in between pieces, like there's laughter. And I think that a lot of people do assume that because I write about the topics I write about, there's no humor in it. Mm-hmm. But
black right now. Like, you're doing a good job.
I know. Thanks. Yeah. I feel like that's a big stereotype when it comes to poets like me, because I'm laughing more than I'm not. Mm-hmm. I find a lot of things funny. I find a lot of juvenile things funny. Like I've been told I have a good sense of humor, and I've been, you know, in the early reviews of this book when it was on NetGalley and people were reviewing it, multiple people noted that they were crying in one piece, laughing out loud at other lines. And I was like, finally, like three of these books that I thought I had put those lines in. And I did, because when I perform them at an open mic or something, people do laugh when in my mind they're supposed to laugh. But I love seeing that in the book, in the reviews of this book, because I like to laugh. My friend that I was having the conversation with, he said some of the people who are the saddest have the best sense of humor, because humor is a healing mechanism and it's a way that we get through things, even just in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I've really honed my sense of humor over the years, and I sometimes like to think that I am downright hilarious, but I do. I love watching. I could watch Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Oh yeah,
over and over and over again. I laugh out loud at those movies. I love The Office. Mm-hmm. I've been a lifelong fan of The Office. I laugh out loud at really anything. I do tend, when I'm watching TV, if it's scripted, it's comedy usually. If it's not scripted, it's usually a crime documentary. So it's the best of both worlds.
That is the best of both. And Forgetting Sarah Marshall is a good example. There's a lot of juvenile jokes in there, but it's like, it cracks you up because everyone in that movie is committed to their craziness or their zaniness. Right. So
yeah, it's the bit, the commitment to the bit, mm-hmm. the commitment to the bit. And I do, like, I'll watch Always Sunny in Philadelphia on loop. I listen to their podcast. I think that they are comedic geniuses, because if someone's just watching it in passing, Always Sunny, they might find it to be quite juvenile or inappropriate. But when you realize how smart those creators are to be able to write in that way, and almost in a prophetic way, like they write a lot like how The Simpsons predict the future, Always Sunny. And they've had moments where they've predicted the future. They're not predicting the future. They see a pattern and they know how it's going to end up because they're looking at the world around them.
Mm-hmm. And for you, as you said, for this new book, the music was just getting good. You're getting these small victories now where people are laughing and they're like, oh yeah, this girl's actually funny. Like,
yeah.
For the finally. Top, yeah, finally recognizing this is real funny. For you, though, as an advocate of these kind of stigmatized topics, like mental health and addiction, and I know these things are getting less and less stigmatized than they were back in the day.
Right.
But what are the small victories for those? Just as, like you said, people are finding the lines and finally recognizing that you're funny. Like, for you as a writer who's been writing about all of these things, and not just in the poetry books, but across different essays and different things, what are the small victories for you, that like those wins that you celebrate where like you feel like this is getting better or there's metrics for hope or whatever it may be?
I mean, a big metric that is with you know, outside of myself, is that so many people are writing about this. Like, there's a whole poetry resurgence thanks to TikTok and those spoken word artists that have, you know, millions of followers, and they're speaking about some of the most traumatic things. So I love just being a small part of the whole, you know. But when it comes to personal moments, it's always been the same since the moment I published my first piece on addiction until now. It's when I get a email or message or someone comes up to me and they say, I didn't think that anyone would understand what I was going through until I read X. Mm-hmm. And helping people feel less alone and more understood has always been like at the center of what I really take seriously, because I, for a very long time, felt very alone in what I was going through and couldn't find anyone because there wasn't really the internet because, you know, I was born in the 80s and life was quite different growing up. Mm-hmm. So knowing that I have people message me and they say like, wow, I read this line and I'm going to go get it tattooed on me. I'm like, whoa, like, I don't like,
that's crazy. Yeah.
Wow. Or, you know, and then to go really on the, you know, really on the deep side, I'll have people message me saying that they, you know, found my book after a failed suicide attempt or something like that. Or, you know, so I like to think that my books find people when they need it.
Almost like in Gotham City when they put the bat light on for Batman, right? Like,
yeah.
We need him now.
Yeah.
Like, this is like, we can handle the regular bits of crime or whatever, like the Gotham City Police Department. They can handle the regular crime. But every now and then the Joker or somebody shows up and like, all right, put the light on. Like, this is above our pay grade.
Right. And like, my books are in stores, but not, you know, there might be a copy or two. 5 at most, you know, like I'm very aware of like my readership. And so when people find my book, it's not because there's 100 of them staring them in the face, you know, mm-hmm. like they find it on a shelf among a mess of other books that they could also connect with, but for whatever reason they've chosen mine. And I don't take that responsibility lightly. And I respond still to this day to every message I get that's in that, you know, on that topic.
So two more questions to wrap up. And they're both weird questions, though. So let's get to the weird question part of the conversation. As a friend, maybe even as a girl, you'll go through life and people ask you like regular questions like, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite movie? I ask you what makes you laugh. What are some of your favorite albums? Those are things that we kind of all commonly discuss and we talk about. It's how we get to know each other. But putting that aside, I'm wondering about you as a poet and as a writer. Like, when your focus is grief and mental health and addiction, sadness, do you have a favorite emotion?
I mean, I like being happy.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like every emotion I have, though, comes with a bit of introspection. So, like, I'm not, even at my happiest, I'm not probably as happy as the average person. but I like smiling and I like having, you know, my family around me. And I don't like feeling sad. I think that sometimes in the back of my head, though, when I'm sad, I'm like, oh, I'll be able to write about this later. But yeah, happiness is my favorite emotion because it's so fleeting. And all emotions are fleeting, but I'm very aware and present when I'm exceptionally happy. Like I soak it in. I say, remember this, because, you know, it's not always going to be here.
It's kind of like going out into the sun after a long winter and getting some vitamin D.
Yeah, I love that. And like, it's been winter here in New Jersey, but last week, for whatever reason, it's been 60 degrees. Today we have snow. Mm-hmm. So I really like leaned into making sure I was going outside because I was like, the 60 degrees is not going to be here mm-hmm. in a few days. So enjoy it now.
And my second weird question, you're a very empathetic person. As you said, you like, you connect with a lot of people. You get stories on DMs, you reach out to people. This is part of your, like, I guess, connection with the books and putting them out there, right? And you are aware of that responsibility and you seem to take it on. And again, empathy is another one of your superpowers. We've talked about a couple of your superpowers already, but empathy is one of your superpowers. And I was wondering if, like, does that empathy extend to God, however you view God? Like, is that a weird question? Because a lot of addiction recovery or seeking or it involves recognizing a higher power, right? And you write a lot about hope as well. And hope can sometimes come from God. So I'm wondering if that extends to God, however you view God, if that makes sense.
Right. I was definitely raised in an Italian, Irish, Catholic home, but we weren't super practicing. So I think that I think it's more of a spiritual thing. But I do like, yeah, there's AA and NA. They're very much based in like, God grant me the serenity. Mm-hmm. But that's why a lot of people leave those programs for different programs that now exist. But you gotta believe in something bigger than yourself. There has to be something better. And then I always think one of my favorite shows ever is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Are you familiar?
Yeah, yes, yes, yes. And the follow-up Angel as well. But Buffy,
yes,
yeah.
I watched. So in, I believe it was season 3. I don't want the fans coming for me because okay. I could be wrong. But I believe it's season 3. And they're introduced to this alternate reality of their reality. And it's terrible. Vampires are ruling the town. There's no, they can't wear color. I'm doing a bad job explaining this, but it's like hell on earth to them. Mm-hmm. They don't, these people that exist here don't know that there is a better world on the other side of this reality, but they're given the opportunity to break the spell and only go there. And one of the demons says, how do you know that that world is better? And the character says, because it has to be. And I feel like that is how I carry my spirituality through. I always think there has to be something better. A better day has to come. My mother has always signed my birthday cards. The best is yet to come, you know, quoting Frank Sinatra. And that's, I think, how I lead and have hope for a better world one day. You can't think that the best is behind you. Or that it's done, because then what is there to live for? So even, I don't know if that's exactly answering your question, but that's really how I carry my hope and spirit through this world, is thinking that the best, a new day, I think I even say it at the end of this, a better day can appear just around the corner, the back of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be as cliche as you want it to sound, but it's true. And the only thing is that you have to stick around for tomorrow to be able to see if it's better or not. And our world right now is a complete and utter mess, but people are still having babies and people are still celebrating birthdays. And because you have to hold on to something and you have to believe that things can get better.
I'm talking to you just right after the Super Bowl. So obviously every Super Bowl, this is not a staggering insight, but every Super Bowl, there's a team that wins and a team that loses. And that team that loses then has to like figure out how to navigate that loss, literally navigate that loss and kind of get through it, knowing that there's another season perhaps, or that they can like maybe get a trade or sign a new player or whatever it may be. There's ways to improve and get better and hopefully come back to the Super Bowl and win.
Yeah. And they're doing that on a national stage. While, I mean, I don't watch it, but I always watch it at the end because I find it fascinating. Like there's a winner and a loser, confetti falls. One group of people is having the best night of their literal lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cameras pan to the other team still on the field crying. And I think that says a lot about how they're experiencing the same day, but two very different emotions.
And confetti falls on everybody regardless.
Yeah, yeah. It, almost adding insult to injury, right? Because it's like the team's colors. But I always find it fascinating watching that. And now with TikTok, we've been able to like see it more. So I've been watching other people's discourse on the idea of like grown men crying on the field and grown men like celebrating on the field and how it's happening on the same field.
Mm-hmm. The book is called The Music Was Just Getting Good. And I asked you if you could like read a poem or two. Is that cool?
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a preference? Do you want me to read certain ones?
No, I was going to leave it ladies' choice. Like you've been kind of reading a number of them on your TikTok and your IG. So I don't know if you wanted to do one you've already done or you want to do a new one. Like,
no.
You know what I mean? Because I always look at them as like singles from an album, right?
Like, I appreciate that. I'll read one I haven't done before. Let's see. I'll read track 24.
Oh, right. Track 24.
So I wrote this one. Literally, I caught a red light. And I looked to my right and there was a funeral home and it was an empty parking lot and it said visitor parking. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting sign to have at a funeral parlor, because like who wants, you're not visitors there, you're grievers. So anyway, I wrote this after that. So it's track 24. I always feel an odd relief whenever I pass a funeral home and notice that its parking lot is empty. No one in this particular neighborhood is sucking on stale mints while someone they love is breathless, sewn into the last dress they'll ever wear. No one is watching themselves smile in a slideshow, a picture frame, or on a glossy poster board they found in Walgreens while coming to grips with never being that person again. No one is having any of those eccentric private thoughts in a public space that buzzes with the constant low hum of elevator music and sporadic sobbing. No one is wondering if they should walk around and greet people they only see when they have a dead person in common. No one is wondering where they're going to put all those flowers or casseroles, since there isn't enough space in the house or refrigerator for all of that sorrow. No one will have to keep a list of who said what to write thank you notes later. Thanks for acknowledging my person died with a fruit basket. No one needs to find where the extra light bulbs are hidden in the basement or decode passwords or worry about how many death certificates they should request. No one needs to fear what tomorrow will be like or the next day or the next. That is because no one is here. The parking lot is empty. What a relief. And let's see.
The song at the end, the currently listening to is Over the Rainbow by Judy Garland. That's an interesting choice for that one.
Yeah, I love that song. And it's just a nice thought, because if we lived in a world where no one died, there would be no funeral homes and no one would be going through this thing. And we could all just live happy. What other one should I? I know what I'll read. I'll read my Peter Pan poem. I read this one every time I perform, but I don't think I haven't put this online yet. So I will read track 80.
All right, when you're ready.
Okay. It's October all over again, and somewhere in this town, a young heart is being let down for the first time in a parking lot. I'm not sure a picture of us exists anymore, and the older I get, the more that becomes my biggest regret. Through all the pros and rabbit holes, I used to pray we'd catch red lights when you take me home. Now I dodge pigeons on my run, and I haven't drank in almost 60 months, but I remember when we warmed wine on the stove and the candle glow. Our old radio station is just static now. It's just so tragic how I no longer know how you spend your days, but I still think of you when a Jack White song plays. I didn't know who I was back then. Back when I used to lean on NyQuil because I couldn't lean on you. Back when I spent my birthday wishes wishing you'd grow up too. Back when I pretended to not know about the other women. Back when Peter Pan told me he'd never grow up, but I didn't listen. Back when I knew you were leaving for the last time, I paid close attention to your exit. Like I do the final colors of autumn when I don't want to let it go, but must let it. And I was currently listening to The Same Boy You've Always Known by The White Stripes, which, as you know, Jack White is the singer of The White Stripes. Ironically, this poem starts about a parking lot too. I didn't realize that when I picked it.
Mm-hmm. And red light as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of thinking when I'm driving.
Yeah, I picked up on that. Yeah. You also released a Spotify playlist as well, right? I'll put a link in the show notes for this, but I just want people to know, to get a sense of who you are and your taste, because the whole point of being online is to be authentic, and you're very much authentic. So the Spotify playlist is another way to kind of get to know you. Again, circling back to that hypothetical first date, you know what I mean? Like, you can get to know somebody by that Spotify playlist.
Oh, and especially this one, because I knew writing this was going to be my last mixtape. So it was kind of self-indulgent, this playlist, the songs I list in this book. Like I pull from places that I guess, I don't know, if this wasn't the last book, I might not have put some of the songs in, but I was like, it's my last one and I love these songs. So they're going in.
All right. The book is called The Music Was Just Getting Good. It is the third one. Stuff I've been feeling lately. And sorry, I haven't texted you back. Sorry, I haven't texted you back as a viral, I guess, poem or journal entry, or how do you phrase it? What is it? What was it exactly?
The internet has called it like a viral poem. Some people call it a viral meme, okay, which I don't love. But yeah.
All right, let's go with viral poem. a lot of people are familiar with that. They kind of seen that. But this one is called The Music Was Just Getting Good. Thank you, Alicia, so much for hanging out. You just mentioned the White Stripes, right? Like, I can tell that we are going to be friends, right? So.
Nice. Thanks so much. This is always a good time.
Yo, that was Alicia, and her poetry collection is The Music Was Just Getting Good. I'm Sammy, host of My Summer Lair, and I highly recommend all three of her poetry mixtape trilogy books. The Music Was Just Getting Good, Stuff I've Been Feeling Lately, and Sorry I Haven't Texted You Back. Typically when you read a book, like say Stephen King or John Grisham or even nonfiction, right? You start on page one and you work your way to the end. With Alicia's The Music Was Just Getting Good, learn to linger. Jump around, open the book for days and moods when you're suffering and lonely and misunderstood. If the book was a playlist, put it on shuffle and see what comes up. Side A are traditional poems, and Side B are the same Side A poems, only now they're blackout poems, like redacted CIA files. And what's left, what's not blacked out, those few words or few lines, reveals fresh connections and unique emotions. After hearing and listening and enjoying this conversation, if you go back to the poems in The Music Was Just Getting Good, there's an authenticity and Alicia-ness that radiates off every page. When we were talking, I brought up the framework of a first date because it's an easy image to digest. Sometimes connections with others are effortless. And sometimes connections are shaky. You don't always get a second date. Beyond that simple framework is the truth we all know and accept. The human experience is messy. We're surrounded by paper towel billboards and we see detergent TV commercials. They offer to clean up so much of the messes we make for a price. But there is no way to clean up the mess of a broken heart. Nothing absorbs grief 10% more. And that's where poetry comes in. It's metaphors and analogy. It's a language you can use to express hurt and loss. Sure, absolutely. But also express joy and delight. Truly, good poetry is the lyrics set to the rhythm of your life. If you're not actively reading poetry, Alicia Cook's writing is an excellent way to start. My poetry shows up in My Pal Sammy, a Substack newsletter. Check it out. Google My Pal Sammy on Substack. Shout out to the one guy who used Bing to find it. Yeah, according to my metrics, these online analytics, somebody Googled me on Bing. They Binged me? They Googled me? I'm losing a thread. Look, subscribe and we can be sarcastic together. And talk about Google versus Bing, I guess. My Pal Sammy on Substack. Thank you so much for listening to me in a Netflix world. Poetry, yo.